Hi, welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. Well, folks, in the second hour of today's show, I have a guest from the Citizens Electoral Council coming to speak to us about a range of issues affecting Australia and the world, largely economic issues, but also very important political questions about the structure of our financial systems. And these are topics that the CEC is very, very heavily engaged with. I've had Craig Isherwood, the Secretary and Leader of the CEC, on the show several times, and we've always had really interesting discussions, and we've kind of covered so many different topics. And I know some of the issues we've covered have been very controversial, such as the questions about Charles Darwin and the theory of evolution, which kind of annoyed a lot of my listeners, I know. And some of it is counterintuitive, some of it is controversial at a deep level, and we may get into some of those questions today as well, because some of the recent publications, the most recent newsletter from the CEC, certainly takes a very harsh look at libertarian philosophy. People like Hayek, who I know is greatly admired by many libertarian thinking people, is pretty strongly attacked in the latest newsletter by Craig. But today, my guest is Eliza Barwick. And Eliza is the editor of the weekly newsletter that the CEC puts out, and she's also on the National Executive Council of the Citizens Electoral Council. So a warm welcome to Eliza Barwick. Welcome to Truth News Radio.
Thanks, Gerald. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Look, it's a great pleasure to have you on the show. And as I said, we always get into some really interesting topics whenever I talk to Craig, and I'm sure we will with you today. I was wondering if we could actually start with that latest newsletter or the latest CEC publication that I had a look at, which really seems to take a very strong broadside attack on the broadly held position that I would call libertarian economics. Mm-hmm. And just to detail for our listeners, the article that Craig wrote begins actually with an open letter to the Catholic Church in Australia, and he's quoting from the Pope, who is trying to put his effort into moving away from the free market financial speculation that he says has caused the global crisis, and Craig obviously concurs with that. He then goes on to talk about the free market in very, very critical, very harsh terms, and he has a very strong go at Maynard Keynes and von Hayek and a whole lot of other people who have been, you know, seen as leading lights on both sides of politics, really, for many generations. So with that as my introduction, could you possibly give us your take on this latest essay or series of essays?
Yes.
By Craig? Yeah.
Sure. It's all a single open letter to the Catholic Church in Australia with a series of sections within that. But we've headlined it an ecumenical response to Evangelii Gaudium, which is the exhortation that the Pope issued on November 26th last year. And we've subheadlined it, Listen to Pope Francis, because certainly within the Church in Australia, we have not heard echoes yet of the nature of what Pope Francis has been saying. And just to give your listeners a little bit of an idea of what he has been saying, and of course it's a religious document, so he starts out, he's calling for a new evangelization and calling on the church to get out from the church buildings and actually get out in a state of mission because we have a crisis. And he talks about that crisis being capable of setting off processes of dehumanisation, which would be hard to reverse, in a similar way to the way we've spoken about an oncoming dark age, not just because of the economic crisis, but also the cultural crisis.
Okay.
But in terms of why he's calling for this new evangelization, it really is the economic crisis that is the key issue, and he spends most of the second chapter of his exhortation talking about that. He says outright that we've created an economy of exclusion where so many people are, a handful of people are able to make a lot of money under the current economic system. There are so many people that are completely excluded, that are left starving, and he described it as a system of dominated by competition and the survival of the fittest, where the powerful feed upon the powerless. He goes on to be a little more specific. He says that the kind of imbalances we're seeing are the result of ideologies which defend the absolute autonomy of the marketplace and yes. financial speculation. And so he said, consequently, they reject the rights of states or governments charged with vigilance for the common good to exercise any form of control, and thus a new form of tyranny is born. And this is exactly what we're seeing played out in Australia, really, where Joe Hockey, the treasurer, has said that the best thing governments can do is get out of the way and let private businesses make money. He said numerous times that the economy is driven by the private sector. It's the private sector that makes money. And so they're absolving government, in a sense, of the responsibility for the common good. And, of course, that's echoed also in his notion of the ending of the age of entitlements, that people shouldn't any longer be entitled to anything, which is, of course, one of the things that the Pope also talks about, which has been reflected in many Catholic Church encyclicals, that we have to be sure to take care of people when they can't work, when they're sick, for reasons that are not, fault of their own.
Yeah. Now, this is a really interesting question, Eliza. One thing that I would like to ask you about is this position that the Pope is taking reflects somewhat a challenge to the whole capitalist ethos, because the whole capitalist ethos is based on the principle that the market decides that, and that the best thing for the common good is to actually have a healthy free market that then lifts everybody up by creating economic opportunities, by creating jobs. What can you just briefly address that?
Yeah, I mean, it's good in theory, but it doesn't work because people manipulate the system, and the powerful are the ones that can manipulate the system, and you see that in terms of currency trading, commodities speculation, these kind of things, where if you have, you've had the likes of the George Soroses who've been able to crush currencies of nations and determine the economic circumstances of nations. So obviously when you have a system like that, it's free for all, and those that are big and powerful can dominate and can manipulate. So we're not saying that you don't have, free enterprise and private industry, and you need to have all of that, but you also need to have government with an oversight to direct the economy and to bring in certain measures that will encourage particularly the productive sector rather than speculation. And that's why we keep coming back to the Glass-Steagall laws, because if you think about the last 30 to 40 years, as free trade and globalization have become more prevalent, more and more of the dollars in circulation per year, and you can get all the percentages, the figures are really shocking, are going toward speculative activity at the best, more and more services as opposed to productive activity. And you saw it even when the quantitative easing occurred after 2008. We put together all the figures showing that lending by banks collapsed and reduced significantly. So even though there was more money in circulation, supposedly to boost the entire financial and economic system, the actual lending going out to private borrowers, families, businesses was dropping. So this has been the story of the last several decades, that the real economy is perishing and collapsing because it's being deprived of any credit. Of course, governments have the capability to create credit, as we did with the original Commonwealth Bank in this country, to fund the building of a nation with long-term, low-interest credit. But, of course, that's something that the free market, I mean, Joe Hockey says governments should not have anything to do with banking whatsoever. And numerous Australian political leaders have said that. Von Hayek himself wanted to ban nation states from being able to issue money or credit. He argued that only private interests should have the right to do that. Mm. So, you know, there's a real dichotomy there, because this notion of the common good is the basis of a successful economy. The things that would benefit most people will build a sustainable economy, whereas if you if what is prevalent is your speculative activity, then what you end up doing, it might be very successful for a while, but you build up bubbles that then burst because you're not actually doing things that are economically sustainable. And the nation itself begins to collapse.
And you also, by continually propping up the already extremely bloated mega corporations and banks, mm-hmm. you only encourage them to become more rapacious in their profit seeking. And I mean, you highlighted a very real problem with the quantitative easing and the lower interest rates, which we had here too. What we see is the banks don't pass that on to the customers. They get the benefit of it. We're now hearing in Europe talk of negative interest rates, and that is that's enough to really do your head in. I don't even fully understand it. But they are seriously talking about negative interest rates. I'd just like to say, I don't actually have an ideological position about the economy. I'm somewhat of an agnostic politically. I can see a lot of merit in a lot of the arguments that libertarians like Ron Paul and those who put forward the pure capitalist, pure free market concept espouse, and I think it makes a lot of sense. I've read some of Hayek's work. I've read The Road to Serfdom, not the whole thing, but I've certainly skimmed through it. I actually did take a lot of value from that. On the other hand, I've seen a lot of libertarians very, very ideological, and I see a spectrum of people, starting from those who are more like the conservative libertarians, who basically are establishment people like Ron Paul, who simply believe that businesses need to be freed up and that too much government is actually hampering the free market. But then the spectrum of libertarian thinking goes all the way into anarcho-capitalism. And of course, anarcho-capitalists, who I know many, some of them are my friends, these people almost completely reject government. They say government itself is an evil. I don't subscribe to these views. But when we get back from the break, we're just going to break. I'd like to consider some of those ideas. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Truth News Radio Australia, going beyond the spin, deception and propaganda of mainstream news. Visit truthnews.com.au and subscribe now.
Welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. I'm talking to my guest, Eliza Barwick, from the Citizens Electoral Commission. And we're going over questions of fundamental economics and the future of the world system and direct connections to that, to what's happening in Australia right now. Just before the break, I was going through some of those ideas that are in the spectrum of what we call libertarian thinking, and contrasting that with what you are putting forward, Eliza. Previously, Craig has described the Citizens Electoral Council as being somewhat like old Labour, pre-World War II Labour in their basic economic outlook. You believe that there needs to be a free market, but you also believe that the government is important, regulation is important, and your position is that natural resources and collective resources like electricity and things like that should not be privately owned. Is that correct, or correct me if I'm wrong?
Yeah, no, that's correct. In terms of, you know, the having government control over things that are really under the ownership of the people of the nation and the future people of the nation. And the system generally that we follow is the American system, also the system of dirigism, which is like a dirigible balloon is a balloon that can be steered. So it's the idea that you have as much free enterprise as possible, but you also have a top-down oversight from government that can steer things by providing, putting tariffs and putting bounties and various things to encourage the things that you need to make sure, because you've got to look into the future and you've got to plan and make sure that certain things are done.
Yeah.
I mean, certain things like making sure that you have an adequate medicine stockpile. You know, it's not necessarily profitable because a lot of those medicines might be destroyed when their due date is reached. And even prisons and things where you don't really want private prisons that want to encourage more crime and so forth, etc. But I was going to mention, actually, because if you think back to pre-nation state times, and maybe we've got a glimpse of it in, you know, the Middle East and so forth.
Yeah.
But, you know, yeah, the pre-nation state era, the medieval period of Europe, I mean, because the idea of government came about, which, I mean, maybe most people don't really have a sense of where that emerged from, but and you had the city-states in ancient Greek times, but the nation-state emerged at the point of the Renaissance in 15th century Europe. And one of the key figures that wrote copiously about the underlying basis for the nation state was Cardinal Nicholas of Cusa. He was a Catholic cardinal, and by some he was considered a second pope, actually. He wrote a number of pieces, and in 1433, one of them on the Catholic Concordance, you read it and it's eerily similar even to the wording of the American Declaration of Independence 340-odd years later, which talked about the basis of legitimate power, you know, rather than just a king having power, seizing power, or the bloodline or something. He said the basis for legitimate power came from the agreement and the consent of the subjects, and thereby through the elective process. And he wrote that this was based on the idea that all men are created equal. That not some are not better because they have a certain name or bloodline. So that idea was really revolutionary at the time.
Indeed, and if I might just interject, it sounds very much like the social contract idea, which of course was very popular in the Enlightenment times with Rousseau and John Stuart Mill. Is there a direct connection there between those philosophies and Nicholas of Cusa, or? I guess we can't be sure.
Well, John Stuart Mill was more of the other side, the other getting into the circles of the Adam Smiths and those types, as far as I know.
Yeah.
But the heritage of Cusa, interestingly enough, did only play out in America, because one of the things that Cusa realised is that with the state of Europe, and of course at that time you had the Black Plague that had spread throughout, so it was pretty rotten in that period, and there were certain advancements later in France under Louis the 11th, kind of a precursor of a nation state, and even in England during the period of Shakespeare and so forth. However, there were people from England and other places that went to the Massachusetts Bay Colony, but of course preceded by Columbus's journey. It wasn't until later with Massachusetts Bay Colony that some of these ideas began to be adopted. But Columbus had actually been provided with the map of where to go by the immediate circles of Cardinal Nicholas of Cusa. One of his friends was Paolo di Toscanelli, who was the famous cartographer. And in the last will and testament of this Cardinal Nicholas of Cusa, he basically bequeathed this map, and they already had contact with Columbus, who was Italian also. And they decided that this had to be the next step, because they kind of had to get outside of Europe and outside of the system which had smothered any possibility of getting nation states. And so, yeah, we would say that the first actual nation state didn't begin until the American Revolution and Declaration of Independence, when they said, look, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, and that the people have the power to overturn government that becomes destructive of these ends. But, of course, all of the work by the Ben Franklins and the Alexander Hamiltons, and particularly Hamilton, because he created the financial basis for America to have its independence, you had to be able to create your own credit.
Yeah.
That was one of the crucial things. And we see that being challenged, actually, and I mentioned to you about Argentina, because Argentina has tried to have a reorganization of their sovereign debt, and the international financial community is saying, you can't do that.
Right.
But, yeah, whether you want to talk about that now or...
I would like to get into that. I would like to just stay with this this debate, if you like, about really, I mean, let's just get it down to a simple level. Maybe it's an oversimplification, but I think it can just help to clarify, to crystallize that there are two fundamental positions. And I think in some ways the reason why Hayek is so well known is that in his writing he did that. He kind of crystallized it into this concept of the free market versus the central planning collectivist model. And his critique of collectivist central planning systems, which is itself debunked by Craig Isherwood, to me still holds a lot of weight. And I know to many of my listeners, so I think it's something that that I need to address in this interview, because we see government having become incredibly bloated, and we see a corporatist system having been developed. And I use that term in the sense that Mussolini used the term when he said fascism is really corporatism. It is a merger of the government and the big corporations. This is such a problem now that a lot of us see that we need to take power away from the government. We certainly don't want to give it to bloated corporations either, but in a way it's a false dichotomy to think that those are even different from each other. They seem to be merged. They seem to be joined at the back.
Yeah, no, well, that form of government that you just described, we are not in favour of either, and it's become something that, you know, it shouldn't be, obviously. I think that the real problem, though, comes back to the people, because if you think about what I was just describing about the basis of the nation state being government of, by and for the people, and dependent upon the citizenry taking responsibility, and not just responsibility for politics, though, because if you think about where does real wealth come from in terms of economics, if you get down to fundamentals, the basis of real economics, in our opinion, is the creative nature of man. Because unlike animals who don't organise economies, human beings have a mind that's not just capable of logic, but of creative reason, which is making leaps in their thinking, completely overturning all their previous modes of thinking and ideas.
We're just going to break. Sorry to interrupt. We're just going to break. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. We'll be right back after this very short break. Don't go.
Thank you.
Welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio. I'm talking to Eliza Barwick of the Citizens Electoral Council today, and we are looking at some philosophical questions. I always like to try to engage with the deeper philosophical questions. I find that the issue of money, the issue of currencies, economy, and the management of banks is a very, very complicated one. And we need to understand what our principles are so we can understand why there is an argument, why there is a disagreement, why there is a debate. I see that there is a fundamental conflict in viewpoint between those who have the radical free market view, who believe almost as an act of faith that by allowing the market to completely self-regulate, that we will be able to create a kind of utopian vision. It's a belief in the magic of the free market. But I also think that there are those who you might call Fabian socialists, who similarly have a magical belief in the power of government to solve problems, coupled with a belief that this is the way to enfranchise the common man. It is the way to create the greater good for the greatest number, and that we need to have that power, and it does confer power to the government. And I could just briefly address Marxism, which is another system of thought which appears to have, again, an almost mystical belief in an automatic or magical force in nature, which is leading us towards some kind of future where everyone will be equal. Now, I'm only raising these, Eliza, because they're kind of like mountain peaks that kind of stand out to highlight systems of thought that have been developed in the past. Can you address what I've said, can you position yourself in relation to those mountain peaks?
I think that you have to look at the base below those peaks. That, as I was saying before, what's more interesting to us is what is real economics, because there's a lot of schools of thought, and you can go through individual criticisms of them, but the basis of our difference with a lot of these schools of thought are that they don't put man, and this is what the Pope is saying too, which is why we agree with him in this instance, they don't put man at the centre in terms of what actually grows economies and shifts economies forward to the next level or platform of ability to feed and clothe and house people and do all the things economies need to do. Is the ability for man to revolutionise his mode of thinking, and in particular to make discoveries about the way the universe works. And if you think of various examples in our lifetimes, where we've made fundamental discoveries, things like putting man on the moon and so forth, that have led to abilities to communicate in distances that we couldn't do before, propulsion and other technologies, and there's, you know, a myriad of other examples. But the ability then to produce is far more efficient. The time that man then has on their hands, because they're driving cars instead of horses and buggies, or we've got excavators that can dig holes rather than men with shovels, allows us then to put more time into, again, the thought processes in understanding the universe and the way that we can better get our resources organized for the benefit of everybody.
Yes.
And so it's that idea that is not being fostered or looked at or concentrated by any of these systems in particular. I mean, they tend to put the emphasis on money. Monetarism right now is the real disease that we're facing.
Yeah.
And certainly the Austrian School of Economics said that monetarism or money is primary. So we're trying to get away from that and say, well, okay, what's the real basis to develop an economy or for economic growth?
Of course, this regulation of money really stems, it basically all hinges on interest rates, doesn't it? It's all about these micro changes to the way in which credit is available to society and controlled by the central banks. And the idea is that you regulate the entire economy through this one little lever called interest rates.
Yeah, it's really insane, really, because money should just be a side issue. It should be available for those who have a good idea to develop. You know, and talk to any manufacturer today, that's not the case. They're shutting down. If there's a good idea, look at all the discoveries that Australians have made. Most of them have gone overseas because we haven't had the system in place which is there to foster the development of the nation. I mean, banks, the original idea of a bank was so that people didn't have to come up with the money themselves to have to fund something, but that you could get access to loans, and this would enable you to enhance your economic development, trade, etc., economic relationships with other countries. But yeah, we don't even have that basis to move from because we don't have a properly functioning economy. What do we produce here anymore in this country?
Indeed. Can I just ask, what do you think about the whole critique, which is very popular on the internet, of money as debt as being fundamentally wrong? I'm, again, not 100% sure of that. I think that there is a logic to the concept of creating money as debt if it is done in a way that is really done with good intentions, because it allows future wealth. It provides a foundation to create future wealth. But there is a huge critique of that, and there are many great minds that have said we shouldn't even have a system that is based on the issuance of money as debt.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, I tend to agree with you that it depends what you use the debt for, doesn't it? Because like today, we're creating a lot of debt, the quantitative easing. You had this campaign by the Customer-Owned Banking Association that had these ads running during the World Cup saying that the big four banks are getting $2.5 billion a year equivalent through these guarantees. So, you know, we're happy to create money and put it into these things, but then on the other hand, we've got to slash this from your pension and slash that from your childcare and that this, that and the other. But yeah, it's not a problem of whether you have money or not. It's a question of your priorities, and we have the ability to create money. That's where it comes from. We create it, but the question is, what do you do with it? And if we're putting it into, for example, the kinds of large-scale infrastructure and development programs that we've laid out in some of our publications in the past, you know, in terms of high-speed rail, water projects, there's so much infrastructure that we need. It would be just beautiful if the government were to announce, okay, we're going to create X amount of credit and we're going to put it at long-term, low-interest interest rates into these projects. We'll set out the tenders, et cetera, and imagine the jobs that would create, how that would just spark everything throughout the economy. A lot of the private sector gets moving as a result of that. But it's a function of government, of taking care of the common good, looking into the future and forecasting what we might need. It's like when Bradfield built the Sydney Harbour Bridge. He didn't create one or two lanes. There's like four lanes going each way or something.
It was scaled up to for the future.
Look into the future, And today, I mean, you look at roads that they're building and they're just building a couple of lanes and you think, one lane or something.
It's incredible, isn't it? I mean, the lack of investment in our infrastructure in Australia is just so staggering. When we see the government spending so much money, we see the government spending vast amounts of money, pouring money into projects. I mean, like the home insulation scheme, just as an example, was a complete disaster. Mm-hmm. When they can't improve the rail lines in Sydney. And, you know, the Sydney rail line hasn't really had a major upgrade in 40 years. I mean, it's just a disaster. And, I totally agree with you that if the government was willing to provide this credit to the people to fund these projects, it would be a fantastic future for Australia. But instead, everything's privatised and then it goes to ridiculous projects. We are going to break. We're coming back for one more segment. I'm with Eliza Barwick. Don't go. Truth News Radio Australia. I'm talking to my guest Eliza Barwick from the Citizens Electoral Council. So, Eliza, we have covered some ground. We've used up most of the hour and I haven't really got into some of the central questions you wanted to talk about. Can you briefly run through the situation in Argentina? Because that was kind of an example that you said was very important to see where the trends may be for the future.
Yeah, and for the global financial system as a whole, because Argentina has essentially made moves to, well, it has in the past, in recent years, since it went into default in 2001, it made moves to restructure its sovereign debt. That is being jumped on from the highest levels of the international financial establishment because they're providing a concrete alternative to the kinds of policies that the Troika, for example, the IMF and the European Union are proposing for countries like Greece, Italy, Portugal, Spain, all of these collapsing economies, which is basically austerity, budget cuts, bail-in, the policies of looting more money from the people and suckering it into the bankrupt financial institutions. So in the case of Argentina, what happened, and they followed the IMF policies to a T, which resulted in their default in 2001. Now, they dumped all those policies, and by 2005, they renegotiated with all of their creditors, well, 92% of their creditors, I should say, where they had to reduce the size of the loans, extend them over a longer period, and at lower interest rates. But 92% of creditors accepted that because this was a country in default. So they said, okay, we're happy with that, that's good. However, there was a handful, the other 8%, which includes two prominent hedge funds based in the City of London, NML Capital and Aurelius Capital Management. And these others held out. They said, we won't accept that. In the meantime, Argentina went ahead and made regular payments with no problems whatsoever, without any access to international capital, I might add. And they completely paid out the IMF loans, they completely paid out the World Bank and a number of other institutions. So they got them off their backs, which was what they wanted to do. Now what is happening, though, is that these hedge funds, or they're called vulture funds locally, are coming in for the kill, and they're demanding full payment of the face value of the bonds that they hold, which they purchased prior to the 2001 default, at rock-bottom prices. They paid cents on the dollar to buy up Argentinian debt in the form of these bonds. So they paid for them very cheap when Argentina was bankrupt and didn't have much option.
Yeah.
And now they want the full face value. And the US court made a decision on the 16th of June, the Supreme Court, that they've got to pay $1.5 billion to these two hedge funds by the 30th of June. What Argentina has said, and they took out a full-page ad signed by the presidency of Argentina in the New York Times and the Washington Post on the 22nd of June, where they said, look, what the total value of the bonds that were not restructured is more than $1.5 billion. It's $15 billion. And if we pay the $1.5, we're going to be up for the $15. What's more, we won't, if we pay that out, we're not going to be able to pay our other creditors that we did renegotiate with. That's worth $120 billion. They're all going to come in and want what they're owed in full if that precedent's been set. So basically that's another $120 billion and Argentina will be again in default. They'll be bankrupt, which could actually, as Lyndon LaRouche, the American statesman and economist, has said this week, it could bring down the entire global financial system. So it's a very interesting example because since 2003, Néstor Kirchner, who was the late husband of the current president, Cristina Fernandez, had reversed entirely the IMF free trade program. They renationalised crucial assets, including the oil, major oil company. They've refocused on industry development, nuclear technologies. They increased investment in science and technology by 937% and repatriated nearly 1,000 scientists who had been driven out under the IMF regime. So they completely reversed all that. And I might add too that one of the things that this court ruling stated was not only that Argentina had to pay up this cash on the 30th, but that also this would allow for Argentina assets anywhere in the world to be seized to execute payment if necessary. And the Uruguayan president actually said, look, they're coming after Argentina's oil and they'll end up proposing that the debt be paid with natural resources. And true to that fashion, the day after the Supreme Court's decision in New York, this hedge fund NML Capital went before Californian courts to demand discovery on the location of Argentine assets. So they're demanding from Chevron Corp, ExxonMobil, Dow Chemical and Apache Corp, which are the partners of the Argentine oil company YPF, that they provide information about where the oil assets may be located. So basically we see this as another form of bail-in, where the banks and the hedge funds are that close to collapse that they're drawing and sucking in everything, and they're quite desperate both to grab their money, but secondly to make an example of Argentina and put down any nation that tries to deal with this, in the sense that, well, Nestor Kirchner was continually saying, look, we will not put the banks ahead of the people, which is basically what the IMF was demanding.
What is the advantage to them, though, to try and force Argentina into economic collapse? Is it a resource grab, or is it, as you say, a statement?
Yeah, it's partly that. I think. I mean, as I said, they need the money. They need to. You have a global financial system that's completely and hopelessly bankrupt and can't keep itself going. So whether it's oil or money or whatever, it's one and the same thing. They can do something with it. But at the same time, as I mentioned, they really want to make an example of Argentina, because the last thing they would want, and this has been brought up and raised by various commentators, is for countries like Greece and other nations who were subject to bail-in and extraordinary austerity in order to pay back their debts to the institutions such as the IMF. The last thing they want is those countries to start doing what Argentina did.
I see.
And Argentina's being backed up by not only Uruguay, but there's a bunch of South American nations that are rallying. The Russians have given them implicit backup and have invited Argentina to go to the BRICS Forum, which is happening in mid-July in Brazil, which they're not a part of, that BRICS, B-R-I-C-S Forum. Brazil, Russia, India, China, usually. But actually, some of the Russians that will be at that forum have been discussing the prospect of an asymmetric response to this financial warfare, such as Sergei Glazyev, a fellow who we know quite well, who's an advisor to President Putin, who has discussed, as you might have heard about, Russia breaking from the US dollar and taking steps to have its own control and issuance of credit through the state banks.
Right.
And this is the kernel of the idea of establishing a reorganized, a new world monetary system, a fair and just monetary system.
Okay.
Which means you have to reorganize the current bankrupt one.
Yes, and we're really moving towards a final catharsis there between the power blocks that represented there with Russia and China and Iran and a lot of South American countries. And I'd imagine that the powers that be that have brought about this crisis in Argentina would like to see Argentina to go into a bail-in type arrangement with austerity measures like they've done in Spain and Greece.
Exactly.
And Argentina, it sounds like it's not going to play that game. They're more likely in this case to simply default on repaying that money. Is that what you're predicting?
Well, they are trying various things. There's a proposal which it's a little bit complicated, but basically they wanted to do what the US courts were suggesting, but under Argentine jurisdiction rather than under the New York court system.
I see.
Avoiding the danger of seizure of assets. But the judge on the case immediately reacted to that and said Argentina is prohibited from carrying out the proposal from that minister who suggested that. So basically they're trying to overrule the ability of Argentina to make decisions on its own sovereign debt and saying, no, this is a global financial matter with a supranational jurisdiction over all financial flows. So it's part of what, you know, the bigger agenda of bail-in is. It's the Bank for International Settlements agenda of having a truly global arbiter. Because remember, these bail-in rules are designed for cross-border resolution of bankrupt banks, that if a major bank collapses in one country, every other country can have to pay up and cough up to bail out that bank, because the global system and the stability of the global system is more important in the Financial Stability Board's writings. They expressly say that that's more important than any individual nation. So this is where you get
scary,
the extreme of, yeah, the real extreme of the idea of not having government. You might not have government, but you've got these institutions with the power to manipulate and control that tell you you're free, where actually you're not.
Tell you you're free, whereas your quality of life is reduced to a miserable existence. Mm-hmm. And these bail-ins basically are the people of the nations forced to pay for the debts created by the bloated bankers that stole all their money in the first place, and then we all have to pay up with austerity measures.
Yes.
Just very, very quickly, we're out of time. Do we see bail-ins coming into Australia? I've really only got 30 seconds, but do we have a bail-in threat coming to Australia?
Well, Hockey's denied it. However, he presided over a meeting of the G20 finance ministers in Washington on April the 11th, and he presented documents saying that it will be ready by the November G20 in Brisbane. And also they put a submission to Treasury, Treasury put a submission to the Financial System Inquiry encouraging bail-in to be adopted.
Right.
So you can look that up on our website for more information.
Absolutely. Now, I'd like to get you on the show again sometime, Eliza, to actually talk more about the Australian situation, because I think you've got some very important material. I really do appreciate you making the time to come today. Thank you so much.
No worries at all. Thank you.
It's been a great pleasure. Well, that's our show for this week, folks. Don't forget to check us out on the internet, and don't forget to subscribe if you've got the time and the money and the inclination. Have a look at truthnews.com.au and become a subscriber. You won't regret it. We'll be back next week. See you then.